Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast, 5 Ways to Improve Reliability in Industrial IoT Systems. I'm your moderator, Brandon Lewis, here with today's speaker, Dr. Edwin DeYoung of Real-Time Innovations. Before we begin, I'd like to more formally introduce Dr. DeYoung, who brings more than 20 years of experience in the software industry to his current role at RTI. He's one of the pioneers of large-scale, real-time publish-subscribe middleware, which is now revolutionizing the Internet of Things. Edwin joined RTI in 2005 following the company's acquisition of Fortech, a company he co-founded in 2002 and led as CEO. Earlier in his career, Edwin was a software consultant specializing in real-time publish-subscribe middleware for combat management systems. Dr. DeYoung holds a PhD in mathematics and physics from Leiden University in the Netherlands. Now on to some housekeeping items before we begin. Today's schedule consists of approximately 45 minutes of presentation, which leaves about 15 minutes at the end of the hour for audience Q&A. Your viewing console consists of a set of windows that you can close, open, move, resize, and maximize to your personal preference. On entry, you'll see a picture of our presenter in the presenter window, biography in the speaker bio window, presentation slides in the slides window, and a Q&A window that allows you to ask questions during the event. When using the Q&A window, simply type a question into the Ask a Question text box, then hit Submit. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the event, and we'll address as many of these as possible in the closing Q&A. Also, if you have any tech support questions, feel free to submit those, and one of our technicians will be happy to assist you. Another important item of note is the set of 7 icons across the bottom of your screen. Clicking the icon on the far left will reset your viewing area to the default configuration. The rest of the icons will open or close a corresponding window. You can hover your mouse over each icon to show what it controls, and of those, the most important may be the handout icon, which is third from the right. This opens a handout window with presenter slides in PDF format that you can follow along with or download for future reference. A final note before we begin is that all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded without prior permission. At this point, we can get started, and I'll hand it off to Dr. DeYoung. Take it away, Edwin.
Thank you, Brandon. Thank you for the introduction. Hello, everybody. Welcome to our webinar today. So today we'll be taking a look at some of the most advanced industrial IoT systems, systems that are deployed in some of the most safety-critical applications. We'll be looking at autonomous vehicles, surgical robots, connected patient care. And in these systems, any type of failure can put human lives at stake. But when implemented well, the same systems can save millions when compared to our world today. So with that thought in mind, let's go take a look into 5 specific ways to intrinsically improve the reliability of these systems. We live in truly exciting times indeed. The most disruptive change in almost every industry is upon us. We're entering the era of smart machines. Driven by the industrial internet, devices, machines, whole systems will be connected together with the cloud. And as a direct result, advanced data correlation, data analytics, deep learning algorithms will be able to take advantage of a resulting wealth of real-time information. And of course, one of the challenges will be to handle the resulting data explosion. And almost every industry will be dealing with exploding amounts of digital data. Just one example is healthcare. Nowadays, successful treatment requires management of an exploding amount of digital data. For example, do you know how much data each patient generates on a day in a hospital? It averages to about 1.5 gigabytes of raw physiological data per day per patient, and that's just one patient. Of course, there's thousands in a hospital. Another example is the automotive industry. It's going through the biggest transformation since the introduction of the original car. Connected cars, autonomous driving will change how we move around between places completely. And the result will be intelligent transportation, where data is flowing around in real time within the car, between cars, between cars and roadside systems, and between cars and control centers that provide transportation services. And trends like these are disrupting almost every industry today. And this also means there's an opportunity to apply same technology or similar technology across industries. And this is exactly why organizations like the Industrial Internet Consortium are focused on a common architecture for the industrial IoT across all industries. And the resulting reference architectures and standards will change how these systems are connected and integrated. And it's very similar in a way to what happened with the original internet. So in search for a common architecture, we analyzed over 1,000 different system designs, and those are designs that our company has been involved in. And these are all, you can call them industrial internet systems, intelligent machines, cyber-physical systems. And some examples of the systems included in our research are in-hospital patient monitoring, a full hospital integration with thousands of patients, hundreds of thousands of medical devices connected. And we'll actually look at an example architecture of a system like that later on. We also looked at autonomous vehicles and autonomous systems in general. Later on, you will see a high-level architecture of an autonomous vehicle. We also look at a surgical robot that requires a 3 kilohertz closed loop to perform surgery on a beating heart. And the question is, when you look at all these systems here, and these are just a few examples, really, what is the architecture that all these systems have in common? So let's start with the highest level view that shows the essential blueprint of all these systems. And this is still at a very high level. And the range of systems is definitely broad. But under the hood, they all share a common architecture. These are all distributed control systems. They have sensors that gather real-time data from the environment. The sensory data is processed by real-time analytics and control algorithms. These algorithms make decisions on which actions to take. And based on these decisions, control commands are then sent to the actuators of the system. There's also operators involved, at least for monitoring purposes, if nothing else. Sometimes there's actually a human in the loop. But we do see that increasingly with these systems that they have higher and higher levels of autonomy. These systems also increasingly have external system interfaces. Industrial IoT actually relies on these external interfaces. And these external interfaces are used for device-to-device as well as device-to-IT connectivity. And to understand industrial IoT architecture, we must really look beyond the scope of that external interface. So what we're going to do, actually, is we're going to expand the data bus architecture that you see here, because all these system components are connected together through a shared data bus. And what we're going to do is we're going to expand that database architecture by pulling it through the external interface. And then, once you do that, what you get is what is now called the layered data bus architecture. The layered data bus architecture was identified by the Industrial Internet Consortium as one of the foundational architectural patterns for the industrial internet. You can read more about the Industrial Internet Reference Architecture, the IIRA, which is available from the IIC website, so you can read about it more there. This example that I'm showing here is actually a drilling automation platform. It comes directly from the IIRA. But similar architectures apply to fleet management systems, for example, for robo-taxis. For hospital-wide patient monitoring systems, for distributed power generation and storage, all those systems have a very similar architecture. This just shows an example for a drilling automation platform. So the bottom section of this diagram shows individual machines. On a drilling platform, we have pressure, acoustic, and thermal sensors. But these machines could also be autonomous vehicles where the sensors are LiDAR, radar, cameras. And then the second level data bus that you see, you know, one level up, implements machine-to-machine or device-to-device or system-to-system communication. And for autonomous vehicles, this would represent the V2V, the vehicle-to-vehicle communication. And then we have the top-level data bus that represents basically the control center or the enterprise or the cloud. This is where individual machines are controlled from and managed from, like predictive maintenance can happen, can be implemented from there. You can also manage a fleet of driverless vehicles from that level. So this is roughly what the layered data bus architecture looks like across these different types of systems. Just very quickly, in case you're not familiar with the Industrial Internet Consortium that basically came up with the layered data bus architecture, it's the world's largest IoT consortium. It's a truly worldwide organization with participation from all continents. And the IIC is working, so all the members are working together to identify common standards and common reference architecture for the industrial internet. They also look at use cases. Much of the work is driven by use cases. And these use cases are basically demonstrate the validity of the reference architecture. And this is actually demonstrated by implementing those use cases as test beds. So that's a little bit of a background there, background in a nutshell on the IIC. The layered data bus architecture is not the only commonality between industrial IoT systems. They also share many non-functional requirements, and here we're listing a few of them. One, obviously, is real-time performance, right, or timeliness of the system. So sub-second or microsecond level response times are often required. These systems must also offer continuous reliability. That's really going to be the main topic of our webinar. There can be no downtime, either accidental or planned. Control must be fully distributed, so there is no single point of failure. IoT systems are typically deployed at the edge or in the field, right? You don't find them in a data center, for example. They're out there on the edge. And that sometimes means that connectivity must be maintained across unreliable networks. And when connectivity fails, the system must continue to autonomously operate within safety parameters, of course. These systems must also support large-scale deployments. These systems are often very large-scale. There can be hundreds of thousands of data or I/O points. We mentioned a hospital earlier, right, with hundreds of thousands of medical devices. NASA's Orion Launch Control System, which also uses the layered data bus architecture, has 300,000 individual data points that are being monitored in real time. So 300,000, that just gives you a sense of the scale here. And lastly, data security, of course, is now key. IoT systems are getting external interfaces, and those external interfaces now become vulnerabilities that need to be protected. So security is pretty key. All right, let's go and look into a little bit more detail now. So how does this layered data bus architecture actually work? Because we need to understand that first before we can get to the reliability aspect. How do devices and systems actually interface? And most importantly, that's really the topic of our webinar today, is how does that then in the end improve reliability? And we'll get there in a few steps. And here we start with step one. And let's forget about the data bus layering for a moment. So here you see a simple version of a data bus architecture. It shows that it is essentially a connection-less architecture. And this way it abstracts from the complexity that you would get from direct point-to-point integration between devices or between systems. And point-to-point integration is what you typically end up with when you use straight network programming, for example, like TCP/IP or socket-level programming. Instead, here all interaction, all communication goes through a common shared data bus. And applications or devices that connect to the data bus are characterized as publishers or providers of data, and subscribers or consumers of data, and many components are actually both at the same time. Applications and devices have no knowledge of each other. They don't need any knowledge of each other because they're all connected through this data bus. So publishers and subscribers only need to know about the topics of the data that they will publish or subscribe to, and you can think of these topics as well-known names. They're basically a string that is well-known throughout the system. and applications then simply publish the data that they produce, and they subscribe to the data that they need to consume. And for example, on this slide, we have a sensor that publishes sensor data. And here we're using a medical example. So here the sensor measures a patient's heart rate. It's represented by this heart rate monitor here. So the heart rate, between quotes, would be one of the topics being published and subscribed to. And then we have a control application that in the end controls our surgical robot there on the right side. And this control application then subscribes to this heart rate data. It will then automatically start receiving heart rate updates. And based on the received heart rate data, the control application then produces commands for the actuator, which in this case is a surgical robot. And we'll learn more about this surgical robot in a minute. The point here is that there is no hard-coded knowledge in these components about each other. The data bus automatically discovers and connects components at runtime, and as a result, the components are very loosely coupled. So in this case, no changes are required to any of the existing applications or devices when you add a second heart rate sensor. Perhaps you want to do this for redundancy reasons. And the same applies when, for example, you add a display to the system. Perhaps at some point the hospital decides to add a surgical theater. That's a room where students, for example, or colleagues can follow an operation on a large display. And this display can be added as a subscriber later on without making any changes to the existing devices, right? Maybe initially the system was never designed with a surgical theater in mind. You can always add that later. And you can even do this at runtime while the system is being deployed. All right, so that's a very simple, you know, initial introduction to the data bus architecture. Let's look at a real example here. This is what the data bus architecture of an autonomous car looks like. This is actually a layered architecture, right? You can see the layered data bus here. And the on-the-car data bus, that's the big data bus that you see here, the on-the-car data bus interconnects all the sensors, so including LiDAR, radar, cameras on the car. It connects all the ICUs and all the processing algorithms that perform data fusion, situational awareness, planning. It also connects to the vehicle control, which sends control commands to the vehicle platform. And the vehicle platform contains the actual actuators on the car, which is, of course, the steering and brake systems. The layer data bus architecture then extends outside the vehicle. It connects to a data bus that offers cloud-based services like real-time traffic information, maps, and you can also implement things like predictive maintenance on vehicles from that cloud, or you can do fleet management from that cloud. So this is what the layered data bus architecture would look like of an autonomous vehicle. Another real example, and this actually shows the deployment view of a layered data bus architecture. This is GE Healthcare, who is implementing a very innovative patient monitoring solution based on the layered data bus architecture. It's a hospital-wide integration, thousands of patients, over 200,000 medical devices. And there are many different device types like ventilators, respirators, incubators, etc. And today, many of those devices are all separate. They don't even have a network interface. Tomorrow, they'll all be connected together in an intelligent distributed system that basically becomes part, an integral part of the care team. And what you see here is a deployment view of the data bus architecture, and it shows the physical connectivity graph. The smallest red dots here that you probably can't even see are the medical devices, and they're wireless. Part of the problem in the hospital today is all the wires coming from those devices. These are wireless devices that are connected to patients. Patients are treated at a particular care unit, et cetera, et cetera, and it connects all the way up to the global hospital level. And the graph basically demonstrates the scale and complexity of the connectivity. In this case, the connectivity was auto-generated under the hood by the data bus. And not only would it be very challenging to design all these connections explicitly, it would actually also not even be sufficient because patients move around between units, right? They go first to the ER, then to the OR, then to the IC, for example. So the connectivity graph is dynamic as patients move between units in the hospital. So this just demonstrates how essential the data bus abstraction is for next generation IoT systems. All right. The second step in understanding layer data bus architecture is to look at data-centric architecture. With data-centric architecture, the interface between applications and devices is the data. There's no direct interaction or invocation between applications, like what you would see with client-server architecture, messaging middleware, remote method invocation, right? Those all connect directly between applications. So here the connection is with the data. So the data bus connects your applications to the data, not to each other. And the five ways to improve reliability, which we will get to momentarily now, directly relate to this. All the data also has an associated data type that makes the interface type safe. The data types are available as metadata, actually, on the data bus. So knowing the format of the data bus can actually make intelligent decisions based on the data content, when to filter data, when to send data. We'll actually see an example of that in a minute. But wait a minute. When you have applications interface with data, isn't that what a database does? So how does a data bus compare to a database? That's a good question. There are actually many similarities, but there's also some fundamental differences. The database, as well as the data bus, both structure data by defining data types. So in a relational database, you would have your data schemas. They also share the concept of a primary key that uniquely specifies related values, like the position of a particular robot. Another commonality is that applications basically read and write data, and these are also called the CRUD operations, where CRUD stands for create, read, update, delete. So there's a lot of commonality, but there's also some fundamental differences. A database stores data. A data bus shares data, so it moves data around rather than storing it somewhere. Another difference is that a database is used for searching data. You can run a query like, at what times was the recorded temperature higher than 150 degrees? The data bus filters data in real time. So rather than running a query, you would run a filter, a continuous filter, like notifying me of all temperature updates higher than 150 degrees. So you can think of it as a continuous query on changing data rather than a one-time query on stored data. So let's again look at an example here. This example is actually based on work done by NASA's Human Robotic Systems Group. They're experimenting with controlling robots on Earth from the International Space Station. And why do you want to do that, you may ask? Well, really what they want to do is control robots on Mars from orbit. And this is an experimental setup. So our Mars rovers that really drive around on Earth communicate with the International Space Station, maybe also with the control center in Houston. And the example here shows how Mars rovers communicate their current position, direction, and speed. So first you define the data type or the data schema. That's just like in a relational database. And this example shows the position, direction, and speed of all robots on Mars. Here we have three. Each robot is identified by a unique name or number. That's the primary key. It's very similar to the primary key in a relational database. And at runtime, the data schema gets populated with actual data. So robots, here we have three robots, right? But it could be any number of robots. They start to insert and update their position, direction, and speed data. Now, it's important to realize that the central table that you see here doesn't actually physically exist. The table is replicated across all publishers and subscribers, so data is not stored anywhere centrally. It's cached with every publisher and with every subscriber, and this is exactly what gives fast local access to the latest data. So when a subscriber needs data, The latest data is already there in its local cache, so you don't need to go and get the latest data from across the network, and now you incur the latency because of that. So it's fast, it's the fast near zero latency access to data that enables the real-time capabilities of the data bus. The third step in understanding layered data bus architecture is to look at quality of service. And to introduce quality of service, we're going to stay with our Mars rovers here. As you can imagine, the communication link between the International Space Station and the Mars rovers is very challenging. It has multi-second delay. Standard protocols like TCP/IP simply won't work. And it really requires an advanced communication protocol to handle this space-to-Earth data exchange. Now, just to get you thinking, contrast this with the minimally invasive robot surgery system, MIRS, from DLR. So this system, and you already saw a little bit of this earlier, this system coordinates three robot arms that perform delicate heart surgery on a beating heart. It's impossible for a surgeon today to manually perform surgery on a beating heart. Imagine trying making a precise incision in a heart while it is beating. So this is why today they stop the heart from beating, put you on life support, and even today that's still an at least somewhat risky and certainly a very invasive procedure. The MERS robot here is based on a similar principle, except that the heart, the patient's heart, is now displayed as a static surface on a screen. This is done through real-time image processing. The surgeon then uses haptic feedback controls perform the surgery, and the robot arms perform the actual surgery while compensating for the beating of the heart. So this, obviously, we need very precise control of the robot arms. That's absolutely critical. And to get that, the system closes a distributed loop between the robot arms and the remote surgeon's controls at 3 kilohertz. So that's 3,000 updates per second. Now compare these 3,000 updates per second in real time with NASA's communication problem from the International Space Station, right? You would think that it requires a very different system architecture, right? You would think that this surgical robot requires a system architecture very different from NASA's architecture. But the reality is both systems are implemented using the exact same layered data bus architecture. And how is this possible? And this is where we come back to quality of service. So far we talked about what data gets shared where. Now we'll look into how it gets shared. There are many different kinds of quality of service you can set. I don't want to get into the details of all of these today. And to explain, I actually want to use an example that is related to the reliability protocol of the data bus. The first choice that quality of service gives you is whether you want to send data reliably or best effort. Sometimes best effort makes most sense. You can think, you know, why is that? We worked so hard to produce this data. I certainly don't want to lose it. But let's look at an example. So when you have a sensor that outputs data at a very high frequency, like maybe 1,000 times a second, if an update gets occasionally lost, it may not make much sense to then go and send a repair packet. That's what the reliability protocol would do, of course. Because by the time that the repair packet is ready to send, the next update is already available because of the high update frequency. So it makes much more sense to just send that. But on the other hand, you know, when you're on a high latency lossy connection, like the space to Earth link, you do want to use a reliable protocol. And the reliability quality of service can be configured very differently for NASA when compared to the surgical robot. So for example, one parameter you can set is how aggressively you send negative acknowledgements, right? So whenever you detect that a packet is missing, you send a negative acknowledgement and back to the publisher, who will then send a repair packet in return. And the question is, how aggressive do you want to be sending those next? Of course, for the surgical robot, you want to be very aggressive and configure it maybe to a few dozen microseconds. But for NASA, if you do the same, you will take out the link, right, just by saturating it with the metadata traffic. So there we configure this timeout at the level of seconds rather than at the level of microseconds. And it's through this kind of reliability, quality of service settings that the layered data bus architecture can be used as a common architecture between Mars rovers and surgical robots. So when you look at the functional design of those systems, they look very much the same. When you look at the quality of service configuration, they look very different. Here's an example of quality of service actually being used. This is in an autonomous car design. And on the car, we have three different sensors, right? There's cameras, LiDAR, and radar. There's also GPS data. There's, of course, the control commands that are sent to the steering and braking systems. And the point here is that these different sensors and the different types of data from these sensors have very different characteristics. Video stream from the camera, for example, is high volume. Video frames are large. But the update frequency is relatively low. Control commands, on the other hand, are small sized, but are sent at a much higher frequency. And also control commands, like the ones controlling the braking system, are more time critical. So control commands should never be delayed by high volume video data that is taking up bandwidth. It's better to occasionally drop a video frame than to drop a control command. So what quality of service allows you to do is prioritize these different types of data relative to each other. The alternative will be separation in hardware, which has been done in the past, right? But that then starts to add more hardware, like network cables, network interfaces to the vehicle, and that adds volume and weight. Now that becomes a problem. So through quality of service configuration, all data can be sent on a single network cable. That's really the point here. And because of quality of service and you know, the way that you can configure it in a very, very flexible manner, because of that, the layered data bus architecture is really the only common architecture that can be used across the entire breadth of the industrial internet for communication between devices, between machines, communication between systems, and from devices and systems back into the cloud. And this can be done whether across high-speed networks, satellite links, radio links. And then when we put it all together, here you see all the data bus functionality put together. We did not even talk about all of it, but we did gain a basic understanding of the functionality. Basic functionality includes publish-subscribe-based data sharing, which results in highly decoupled and scalable system architecture. This is supported by a scalable discovery protocol. This protocol detects publishers and subscribers in real time as they come online. Under the hood, the protocol then creates all the required network level connections, like the socket connections, and it maintains those connections, also if exceptions occur, like temporary disconnects. It includes quality of service, as we just saw, which allows applications to be deployed across very different environments, from edge to the cloud. It also provides deployment flexibility. You can make changes where components are deployed. And finally, most importantly, the data bus implements data-centric architecture that includes a type-safe interface, so all data is typed. The life cycle of data is managed through the CRUD, the create, read, update, delete operations. And the data bus basically manages the overall distributed system state. And our RTI Connect DDS product family of software basically implements this, this data bus. So that explains why I'm talking about this. All right. So because here I just want to illustrate the power of data centricity by using a simple example just quickly. Because the data bus knows the structure of the data, and by using quality of service configuration, the data bus can make all kinds of intelligent decisions. And this results in a very efficient data flow that optimizes the use of the resources in the system, like network bandwidth, CPU power, etc. Let's look at a quick example. So we go back to our surgical robot, and in a hospital, we typically have multiple operating rooms, right? Multiple ORs, and they're all equipped with their own surgical robot. So we can have multiple surgeries going on at the same time. So let's see what happens. So here we have our surgical robot that sends update at 3 kilohertz. Because of the criticality of these updates, we're sending them reliably. And then we have our operation theater, where people are watching a surgery. And in this case, we're watching the surgery of a particular patient named Joe. So what the operation theater does, or what the database does, it installs a content filter. So only updates from patient Joe are received. The content filter is actually pushed to the publisher, so only updates related to Joe are sent. So the filter is on the publisher side. So here you see how the database can intelligently optimize itself. Another example is the display that we have in the operating theater, right? This display is refreshed at, let's say, 60 hertz. So now we install a time-based filter because even though updates are available 3,000 times a second, we really are going to need only 60 because that's as many as we can display. And to make these things a little bit more interesting, the operating theater subscribes best efforts. You can see in the top left corner there, you can see the best effort now appear. Because if an update on the display is occasionally missed, it won't affect the user experience, right? So we can easily subscribe best effort. So even though the publisher offers reliable delivery, it will switch to best effort. Well, at least for this particular subscriber as well. So here you can see how the database basically sets up dedicated communication links, communication channels, based on the data that is actually needed and also based on quality of service settings. All right, so now we get to the beef. How does the layered database architecture improve reliability? And we're now ready to take a look at that. So what we're going to do here is we're going to compare a message-based solution versus data-centric architecture. And we'll start with a very simple, everyday example just to give you a taste. So here we have two people, Anne and John, who are trying to coordinate a meeting. And they're using email, just like you and I would. And this is actually not unlike two robots on Mars trying to coordinate a rendezvous time and place. So what's happening here? Anne, who's a customer, is asking John, can you visit us on January 23rd? John, of course, says yes. And something comes up, and Anne said, well, actually, 23rd is booked. How about next month, the 20th? John, of course, being very flexible, says, okay. Something else comes up, and Anne says, well, we have to push this out to March the 6th. That will be better. John, still being very flexible, says, okay. And also Anne asks, and can you stay longer? Well, John, reaching the end of his flexibility there, says, well, how about starting half an hour earlier? Anne is fine with that. So they now have their meeting set up. But now imagine that John misses the message where Anne is asking to move the meeting to March 6th. So that one disappears. As a result, John's okay is also not sent. And now John and Anne have a different understanding of when their meeting is. Anne thinks it's in March. John thinks it's still in February. This is called divergent state in distributed system, or also split brain syndrome. And bad incidents have happened because of this problem. It's very hard to recover from a divergent state in distributed systems. So let's now apply data-centric architecture to the problem. So instead of sending messages about changes to the meeting, we send the actual state itself. And this is very much like calendar invites, as you would send them today, right? So here we actually send the full information on the meeting. And as the meeting date and time changes, you know, we send updates, which every update represents the full state of when the meeting is. So now we just move the meeting to March the 6th. Maybe we add some dial-in info. We changed the meeting to half an hour earlier, right, which was what they agreed on last. And now, if that update on March the 6th drops in the middle there, right? So John never receives that. It's not a problem because in the end, you know, they both converge to the same state. The point is, you know, with messaging, if a message is lost, you potentially end up with divergent state. With data-centric architecture, when you communicate full state, the states will always converge, even when an update is lost. So it's more robust to communicate state directly rather than having a conversation about the state. All right, so this is just a teaser to give you an idea of the direction that we will be going. And we're now going to have a look at the five specific ways which the layered database architecture helps improving reliability. And we're going to use examples here for everything. So we're back on Mars, and we'll basically start with the observation that we just made through the informal example, which is that communicating full state is better than communicating messages about changes to the state. So when you design the data model for your system, make sure that it represents system state. We just informally saw this results in convergent state, even when data can be lost. So let's step through an example here. So here we use our Mars rover, which is communicating its current position with the International Space Station. And in reality, there's more data to communicate, right? We saw that earlier. There's also speed and direction, but here we're keeping it simple, just position information, so we can keep a nice overview during the example. So again, let's first look at messaging-based communication to see the problem. So our rover starts driving around. So here we see the robot updating its position as it is driving around on Mars. It sends a message to the International Space Station with its position change, and it does so periodically as it drives around. As the International Space Station receives those messages, it will update its local state. Right? So after receiving all the messages, the states are now in sync. But now assume that the International Space Station misses that second update. As a result, the local state at the International Space Station now only gets updated twice, and the states are now permanently out of sync as a result of that. And it requires explicit detection and recovery to fix this erroneous state. So, don't do that. Don't use messaging about changes to the states. So let's do this again, but this time we're going to communicate full state. So here's our first position update, and as you can see, we are now sending full state information. And as the Mars rover moves around, it keeps sending full state information. And now, if the International Space Station misses that second update, after the third update, they still converge. So the lesson learned here is always communicate state, do not send messages about the state with changes, and you have to realize that sometimes it's compelling to just send state changes because it's less data to send. But keep in mind that that's a trade-off between saving bandwidth and intrinsic reliability, because with full state communication, that's basically what you're looking at. You're looking at intrinsic reliability. And now I can hear you say, well, not really, I can almost hear you say, wait a minute, you know, when that second update is missed by the International Space Station, aren't the states inconsistent at that one point in time? Isn't that still a problem, even though it does get fixed by subsequent updates? This is where we have to realize that time is data too. So make sure to include time in your data model. Or in other words, timestamp all data. In industrial IoT systems, most data is related to a point in time. Mostly, this is not the time at which data was produced. It's the time of the observation. So when you think about a Kalman filter, for example, as the filter produces tracks, and a track is position and velocity information, estimated position and velocity information about objects that you're tracking in your environment. So as the filter produces tracks, it does this from sensor measurements, Right? These measurements come from sensors and they have a timestamp. The track timestamp is the same as the measurement timestamp used in its calculation. It's not the timestamp of when the track was calculated, which is always a little bit later. So all the timestamp values in the system originally come from sensor data or edge data. So let's go back to the data schema that we had for our Mars rover from earlier. And here you can see how we now have added a timestamp column. So now our data model includes time. So now let's go back to the example and add time to it. Right, so we're now going to change our table there. And here you can see it now includes time. Data now has a timestamp. So our Mars rover starts driving around again, and as it publishes its state, you can see it now also includes a timestamp. That's the last value there. And let's say that this particular update doesn't make it to the International Space Station for whatever reason. So the ISS misses this update, but because the data includes time, you can basically conclude that even though the states are not equivalent, they are not inconsistent either. Both states, even though they are different, represent valid observation of the robot's position just at different points in time. And since time is part of our data model now, this is now explicit. So the result is that every system component always has access to the known latest state, and you can make decisions based on the latest information. Decisions can be made on prediction or time projection known from the latest known state. So for example, if the International Space Station wants to see if the robot is close to a ravine, it can use the latest position that it has, plus the speed and direction information, and then predict from the timestamp of the latest update to either the current time or maybe sometime in the future. It can predict where the robot will be with a certain level of accuracy. And most decisions in industrial IoT systems include predictive elements anyway. So what you want to do here is make sure that you include time in your data model. And in that way, there's always a latest known state available to all system components. And that results in more responsive systems, because in any point in time, there's always data to base decisions on. Internal state is state two. So think about externalizing local state of your application processes. This means that applications should publish and subscribe to their own local state. Here, we're looking at an abstract example. We have an application A that subscribes to input data X. It publishes output data Y, and it implements a state machine internally where every output Y is computed using the current state S and inputs X. So here we have our local state that models our state machine. The computation also updates the local state. An example could be, again, a Kalman filter, right, where X are the sensor measurements. The output Y is the estimated position and speed data of objects being tracked. And the local state could include the covariance matrix that represents the accuracy of the estimate. And it's used as a gating condition when correlating the object's current state to new measurements. And although generally the local state is not needed outside the application, it is still a good idea to publish it and subscribe to it. And it basically turns your application process into a stateless process. And this has all kinds of advantages. If our application fails for some reason, then the system can restart that application, possibly hosted elsewhere in the network. And since the application is subscribed to its own local state, the rebooted copy of the application will read its latest state from the data bus. Next, it starts reading the input, and it starts producing output relative to the latest known state that it received from the data bus. The backup application A prime here can also be an active standby that is already subscribed to S and local state S. It is then ready to take over once the failure of the primary application A is detected, and that minimizes then recovery time. The same can be done during a controlled shutdown of applications, and this allows applications to be dynamically redeployed. For example, when you're performing maintenance on hardware or when you're load balancing the system. So in this way, applications can be redeployed anywhere on the network while the system is being deployed. A whole different advantage is that it's now easy to remotely monitor and debug applications. So you can monitor their internal state by simply subscribing to it. And our Databus development platform actually includes tools that make it easy to do this. Just click on the topics you'd like to monitor, and you will be able to observe now also the application's internal state. So the lesson learned here is externalize local state, implement stateless processes, and that improves high availability. It also enables dynamic redeployment of applications and remote monitoring and debugging. All right, so let's go back to Mars and implement idempotent processes. And what does that even mean? So I'm using the term here in the computer science sense, although it's loosely based on the idempotence property in math. So it means that there's no effect on system state if the same input is offered and processed twice in a row. We'll go through a quick example here that shows that state is actually an idempotent element in data-centric architecture. So we have our robot starting to drive around again. It publishes its updated state, and again, it's full state. But for some reason, a duplicate update shows up at the International Space Station. It might happen because of a variety of reasons, like alternate routing, duplication from a failover. So now the first update gets applied at the International Space Station, so our state is now updated. But now note that we can safely apply the duplicate update without side effects. What you see here is that state is an idempotent element. So you can actually unit test applications against this property, just offer them duplicate inputs during testing. So this also allows you to publish state updates even when there are no changes, right? Even applications that are not driven by periodic input can be implemented by publishing state periodically. This can be used as an alternative design to using the reliability protocol in scenarios where such a protocol is not practical. The reliability protocol works by sending and receiving ACKs and NACKs, as we said earlier, and the meta traffic back can sometimes be problematic. So in that case, you can set up the publisher as a periodic process, and it can even publish state at a high frequency, at a much higher frequency than it receives input. And rather than waiting for next to come back from the subscriber, the publisher takes a proactive role and simply sends periodic updates proactively. And these will then include duplicates if no state changes occur between those updates. You can think of these proactive updates as proactive resends. And it results in a very steady load of the network and very predictable behavior. It does come at the expense of additional network bandwidth users, of course. That's the trade-off. So use the idempotent property of state in data-centric design. It intrinsically improves fault tolerance and can also be used to improve predictability. So our last step here, for our last property, we're going to stick with math. Here the idea is to implement processes that are commutative. So this means that the order in which updates are received is not relevant. Updates can basically be received in any order. So we'll look at a quick example here. As you will see, this property depends, again, on time being part of the data model. So we're back on Mars, and our robot starts driving again. And produces its updates. And for some reason, as you can see here, those updates arrive in reverse order at the International Space Station. This can happen because of a variety of reasons. Again, it might be a synchronization issue during failover. It might be alternate routing. And now, first we apply the most recent update on the International Space Station. So after that first update, so here you can see that the two are reversed, right? So now we apply the most recent update first, and that right away brings the two states fully in sync. And then what happens is you can simply ignore the older update. Our data bus implementation actually has built-in logic to ignore older updates automatically. So although ignoring older updates is always an option, sometimes older information can still be of value. An example is, again, a Kalman filter. So let's say the filter receives older sensor measurements. These measurements can still be applied to improve the quality or the accuracy of the estimated state. So it's a design option that you have. Again, you can unit test against this property, simply offer input in reverse order during testing. So the result of implementing commutative processes is, again, a more responsive system. The system does not rely on a strict delivery order on the input. So system components can always proceed with the latest data received. There's no additional latency because previous data must be processed first for correct behavior. And this is a great property for real-time systems where response time, as we know, is critical. So in summary, let's put it all together. The layered data bus architecture has been identified as one of the foundational architectural patterns for the industrial IoT. And today, we took a closer look at the architectural properties, or at least some of the architectural properties, that you will want to exploit. Always communicate state, not messages about the state. Don't forget to include time in your data model. Most data in IoT systems relate to observations, which are valid at one particular point in time. So when you communicate state, include local state as well. In fact, make it part of your data model. The result then, when you make internal state part of the data model, is stateless processes, which fully rely on the data bus to manage state. This provides deployment flexibility, and it can also be used to implement high availability. And finally, implement application processes that are both idempotent and commutative. Communicating state helps making that easy, as we saw here. So the result are then systems that are intrinsically more fault-tolerant, more responsive, and more reliable overall. All right. Well, I hope that you found this a source of inspiration for your current or your next system design. It's not rocket science, although it is being used by rocket scientists. NASA actually uses data-centric architecture, not only for their Mars robots, but also for the Orion launch control system that will ultimately take people to Mars. If you're interested in discussing layered data bus architecture more, I'm definitely always available to do so. My email address is simple. It's edwin@rti.com. And also, you can still join us next week if you want in Munich, Germany, for our Connext conference. We'll have experts in IoT systems and data-centric architecture present. You can exchange experience and ideas with coworkers, and if it's closer to home, you can also join us in Boston next month. Just follow the link that's here on the slide. And with that, I would like to thank you for your interest and attention. And with that, I hand it back to you, Brandon. And sorry for running a little bit long.
Oh, no problem. It was really good stuff there, Edwin. There's some really great application examples in the way you laid it out with the steps. Think will prove very helpful to some of our audience today. That takes us into the Q&A portion of the event. We got a couple minutes left, so keep your questions coming in, and anything that we don't get to, we'll make sure that the appropriate RTI representatives follow up. One thing here, just to get this out of the way, Edwin, is what tools are out there that helps implement a layered data bus application? What's available to the market right now?
Right. Very, very good question. It's actually the reason why RTI spends time on this topic. We actually have a whole tool set available for that. So our core technology that we provide is actually a data bus implementation. So it implements all the functionality of a data bus with the data centricity, the discovery, publish, subscribe, everything, and then a whole tool set around it. So monitoring applications internal state remotely is something that you can do using our tools. Also, we have special solutions for creating the layering in the data bus architecture We have tools for basically bridging data between the different data bus levels. So, it's an architecture, right? So you can always implement it from scratch, but there's definitely tools and data bus implementations available today. Ours is based on the DDS standard. DDS stands for Data Distribution Service. It's been proven, right? We talked about over 1,000 different system designs earlier. Those are all based on our data bus implementation. There's no need to start from scratch there. There's already field proven data bus implementations and tool sets out there. And if you want to know more about that, definitely come talk to us.
Great. Time for about one more here. Does discovery rely on any central services, and for that matter, does the database, does the data bus either?
Right. That's a very good question, and I realize we didn't go down to that level of detail. It really depends on how the data bus is implemented, right? If you do like a straightforward implementation, you could implement the data bus as a central broker. Right? Publishers first send their data to the broker, and then the broker distributes it to the subscribers. That's not the way how we do it. It's definitely not the way how to do it for a scalable real-time system. So our implementation is purely peer-to-peer. There's no central services anywhere. So that just answers the first part of the question. Are there any central services in the data bus? No, not in our implementation. They're not strictly peer-to-peer. And then, of course, the intriguing question is, but then how does discovery work? Right? There's actually a whole fully distributed discovery protocol implemented in the data bus, where when a publisher comes online, it announces its presence to everybody on the network. Subscribers will receive that. They will send a handshake back. And there's a couple of phases involved in the discovery. And then the discovery protocol also monitors the health of the difference of the various system components, right? Are they still online? Are they maybe temporarily offline? Are they maybe shut down? So it maintains the connectivity graph. So the connectivity graph that we saw on an earlier slide, right, GE Healthcare and their hospital-wide patient monitoring solution, that connectivity graph is a direct result of the discovery protocol connecting, matching publishers and subscribers. But it's all fully distributed. There's no central component in it anywhere.
Great. Good stuff. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. And for those of you who had questions, I know there were several of you. We'll make sure to have the appropriate representatives from Real Time Innovation follow up. I'd like to thank Dr. Edward Young of Real Time Innovations for outlining some of those steps there and how to build real-time, reliable industrial IoT systems. And we at Open Systems Media and RTI would also like to thank you, the audience, for attending today and contributing some good questions. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will be made available there as well. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media's eCasts archived there as MP3s. Thanks again for attending, and have a great day.